Hey, good day, everybody. Welcome to what is the final OIG roundtable of 2024. Thanks again to everybody who has stuck by us, participated in not only our OIG roundtables, but also our LinkedIn Live events and has supported advice through the years. We continue to grow. 2025 is going to be an even stronger year than 2024. As we continue to grow in our followers on LinkedIn, we've now got well over 50,000 people following us, which is great. We appreciate that. We continue to grow as a company. We continue to grow and expand our work in the payment integrity space. And it's no thanks to the people that participate in our weekly podcasts, our roundtables, and of course, the advise team, which continues to grow. And as we continue to bring on more and seasoned people. So thanks again. As part of 2024 end of year, of course, we want to do what everybody else is doing, a wrap up. For those of you that participated in our LinkedIn Live a couple days ago, where we had Mandy, one of the managers on our SIU team, and David Bolden, our manager for audits, go through some of the things that they've been seeing. We want to take a little bit of a different look from that criminal civil administrative perspective of what the potential things were in 2024, some predictions for 2025. As always, I've got Wade McFall, retired assistant special agent in charge from the LA field office and now one of the managers on our SIU investigative team, and Matt Kachansky, the retired special agent in charge from HHS OIG, the retired Northeast UPIC director, and now the director of our payment integrity team here at Advise. And, you know, we've been seeing a bunch of things. I think, you know, first and foremost for me, because a lot of the work that I do here at Advise is subject matter expertise, expert writing, reporting, testifying, and the like. You know, this past year, I saw a little bit of an uptick on QTAMs this year and last year in QTAMs that were declined by the U.S. Attorney's Office, in which the relator of the case and their attorney were looking to pursue the matter on their own. And in a lot of these instances, what you can clearly glean was that it wasn't that these weren't good cases. In fact, several of the ones that I worked on resulted in resolutions from the relator to the defendant with money being paid out and things of that sort. But it was really, it seemed more of a resource allocation issue. Not enough prosecutors, not enough AUSAs, not enough OIG agents to work the cases. And so cases get declined. U.S. Attorney's Office is very happy to support as they can these cases, because at the end of the day, if they get resolved, there's money. So I think we're going to probably see in 2025 that continuation of an uptick in declined QTAMs that then are pursued separately. And I think that's going to be because there continue to be flat budgets in some regards. We hear it all the time from our friends over at OIG, open vacancies for roles, reduced budgets for the ability to hire and backfill a lot of the positions that may be there. So, you know, again, it's this whole premise of doing more with less, which you cannot do. It is impossible to do more with less. You can try to do the same with less. But it's very hard to do more with less. So I think we're going to see an uptick when it comes to QTAMs and things of that sort. The other piece that I think we're going to start to see make a resurgence is going to be ambulance fraud cases. We do some work here with a payer of ambulance claims, a third-party administrator. We do some very niche work for ambulance work, primarily non-emergency, non-routine cases that are billed out as emergency cases. The classic example is the resident of the skilled nursing facility where the patient had blood work drawn and they have an elevated white blood cell count. And the attending physician says, I need to have this patient evaluated in the emergency room. It's not really an emergency in that sense, but what the ambulance provider does is, because it is an unscheduled trip to the emergency room, they treat it as an emergency, they bill it out as an emergency when the documentation really doesn't support that it is an emergency case. We see those all the time, and hearing that there are some upticks in that in the space. So I think we're going to see, again, I love to use this phrase, the circus doesn't change, it's the clowns in the circus. Ambulance cases were around forever, and we're going to start seeing that as an uptick. We did see a lot in telefrauds, right? During the public health emergency, the genie was out of the bottle, the cat was out of the bag. Telemedicine became a prevalent part during COVID and has remained as such through the use of technology and the use of modifier 95 for a telemedicine visit. And as a result of that, we're seeing a lot of collateral frauds that continue to grow in the DME space, the genetic testing space, and the like. So, Wade, I want to go to you first because you have spent a fair amount of time in the Medicaid space, looking at things in the Medicaid space. And so Medicaid, unfortunately, tends to get a beating when it comes to fraud, waste, and abuse, an absolute beating. What are your predictions? What do you see as being some of the fraud schemes out there in 2025? And what are some of the things to look for in combating them from that fraud, waste, abuse perspective in the SIU?
Well, I think first we have to look back at like you brought up the public health emergency, the COVID situation, where a lot of things changed during that. You mentioned telehealth, but even a lot of the requirements for, we talked a lot about adult daycare and pediatric medical daycare. During the public health emergency, the requirements changed drastically, where they really didn't have to do a whole lot in order to still bill for the daily per diem. In the medical daycare situation, there was, although the regs were relaxed, not quite as much as the adult daycare, but we didn't see quite as much fraud in that because just of the nature of it, where they still did medical procedures on the pediatric patients that, needed it. So that by its nature really had some documentary evidence that came along with it. Whereas the adult daycare, where they just really had to show up, it's a social daycare. Prior to the public health emergency, there were some regulations where they had to show up for a certain amount of time. They had to be present. They had, sign-in sheets, what time they checked in, what time they checked out. All that went away during the public health emergency. And they only had to do, and it probably varied by state, obviously, because it's Medicaid and the MLTC departments are different. But one that I was dealing with the most, change regulations where they had to do three things, and the way this statute was written was problematic because they had to do either, well, they had to meet the member in person, a face-to-face meeting, they had to provide meals, and here's where the problem was, that the statute said, and they had to have telephonic contact. Well, nobody interpreted that as they really had to do all three, because if you're meeting in person, why would you need to also have telephonic contact with them? So it really should have been meet in person, provide meals, or have telephonic contact with them. So we had a lot of referrals on these types of cases and worked a lot of them, because even though they had to do much less, they just really didn't do anything, and the documentation was horrible. So they had, like, check boxes were saying they delivered a meal this day, but they didn't have any really documentation on time or time of phone calls or meet. So it was really, they changed it so much that they really helped out the agencies that were doing this, because they could still get the daily per diem with doing literally like a 3-minute phone call. They could get the same amount of money as if they had the member in their daycare for a whole day, feeding them, keeping them occupied with activities, but they didn't even do the minimum to do that. They just billed it, and it was across the board for all the members that were normally there in person. So that kind of thing, now that the public health emergency is, a few years behind us, I think we'll stop seeing those types of cases, because, we only look at cases that go back 3, 4 years, and now that that has sunsetted, as they call it, we won't be seeing those anymore. But I think some of the, like you were talking about, telehealth, a lot of the regulations, they didn't go back to what they were before. They're like, they've changed. They're probably still a little bit lax. So I think we're going to see, moving forward, we're going to see a lot of referrals and issues and work that we're going to be doing on regulations that have been altered due to the public health emergency, much like the telehealth, but other things as well.
So one thing that's interesting in that space is that in today's world with technology, it actually is pretty easy to be able to demonstrate that you delivered the meals and all. I mean, look, you get your package from Amazon and it shows your package is delivered. You get an email, your package is delivered. You click, and what do you get? You get a photograph of your item. Now we know that there are the porch pirates and the thieves where they take the picture and then they steal it, whatever. And that may be the case with foodstuffs. I have a harder time thinking that someone is going to steal, you know, a chicken thigh, you know, green beans and mashed potatoes that someone has for lunch. But you never know. But, you know, one would think, particularly in the sense that in adult daycare, the documentation really is minimal. And you know this from having done this for a little bit, that the documentation is minimal, but voluminous. And so, you know, you have to take into consideration the fact that you might only be looking at, you may be looking at documents that are easy to read and interpret, but you may have 5,000-6,000 pages of records to go through, because each person who goes to an adult daycare, if they go every day, there has to be a record every day. And if they're getting meals and they're getting this, they're getting that, there's got to be records of all that. So it does become voluminous, which kind of gets to the piece of the puzzle that one should never ascribe the dollar value for a fraud case to the amount of time required to conduct that investigation. We talk a lot about this in our SIU process improvement when we talk about what is the right number of cases for an investigator. And I don't want to divert too much from this in the conversation, but oftentimes we get asked that question by leaders of payment integrity groups. And the answer always is there is no right answer as to what the right number of cases is, because a $6,000 case could take as much time or more than a $1 million case. So looking at something that has, like an adult daycare case, which is pretty straightforward as far as, you know, whether they were there or not, it's the volume of records that can, you know, potentially be a piece of that puzzle. But, you know, what, so I do think that we're going to continue to see, now that the public health emergency is over, while the telefraud cases are still going to be out there, and a lot of the frauds that are involved with the genetic testing, the DME, all of that stuff that we're continuing to see, we're going to see, I think, a little bit of, now that the, you know, some of the things out there are going to revert back, but, you know, we're just still learning the fraud schemes as a result of COVID, even though we're now going into year, March will be 5 years since the public health emergency was enacted, right? March of 2020. And so, you know, unfortunately, the wheels take a little bit until we get there. But I do think you're right. You know, the adult daycare piece of that puzzle is going to continue on. And then to an extent, pediatric daycare, medical daycare, right? And the things associated with those therapies, because that is kind of a ripe area. We always focus on what happens in the Medicare, Medicaid commercial space from adults. We tend to sometimes forget pediatric care. It's a little bit like in the dental space. Everybody always thinks in terms of dental fraud. We're thinking about adults for dental fraud, but people tend to forget about, you know, how many teeth has a child had pulled, right? You know, at milk bottle syndrome and all of that. And there's a ton of that fraud that goes on. So I think you're right. We're going to start to see a lot of that kind of kicking up in 2025, because there are areas that people tend to forget about from that cyclical nature of doing these different frauds. Yeah. So Matt, you know, 2025, so 2024, we also saw a huge uptick in behavioral health fraud. You know, one of the biggest things that we found in that space was a lack of expertise in BH and ABA therapy audits and reviews. And, you know, we are currently staffing in excess of 20 auditors that are focused very heavily on behavioral health and ABA fraud. And we're finding that the return on investment in our SIU, on our SIU teams for this, is really unbelievable, because it's an area that no one ever wanted to touch. It was kind of a, you know, it's one of those touchy subjects, right? No one wants to touch an area that that has a social component to it. And it's, I think it's an area that we're going to see a much larger focus on going forward in 2025.
Yes. And it's getting, because the types of therapy that they're doing, the ABA therapy, the family-centered therapy, it's becoming more and more popular, you know, where it's, you know, with the provider community, because it does get the family involved. It gets more than one practitioner involved at the same time. The problem is the billing for it and the policies behind the billing haven't caught up with the advances in the clinical approach. So I'll give you an example of, you know, a therapist doing this family-centered therapy. It might be two therapists at the same time working with the child, you know, with the family there or whatever it might be. And they both bill for, you know, say they each bill for an hour. So it's the bill is for 2 hours, but the patient was only there for one. A lot of policies are you can't do it that way. You've got to bill for, you got to split that time or take one out or whatever it might be. So there's a lot of issues with that. So it's really a touchy subject to approach. And I've had a few of those cases myself just recently. So they're very touchy. The other thing that's very touchy and that's going to be a matter of focus for a lot of the Medicaid programs, especially the ones we're seeing in our plans, is the CD pass, where family members are the ones taking care of the member in their homes. You know, so if they don't do the, you know, if they're not doing what they're supposed to be doing, you know, the patient is the victim, but the patient is also might be the, you know, the grandfather of the caregiver.
Talk about the fox watching the hen house. I mean, how, right? You've got the grandchild taking care of the grandparent, or the child taking care of the parent and getting paid at the end of the shift. And who's to say that it's none the wiser,
We had instances where the parent went to another country for 2 weeks, but the kids still billed for the services for that parent. But the parent wasn't going to say anything about that because it's their kid. So right. It's a very tough way to, you know, it's a tough enforcement of that. And it's the wild, wild west. And I know the state of New York is trying to tighten that up. And I know the OMIG in New York, that's an area of focus for them. And that's where we're going to be doing a lot of our work and for our plans there. Another is, you know, DME is always, we've had a lot of cases just recently on shoe inserts. You know, it used to be the diabetic shoes. Now it's the inserts. And we're seeing, you know, they're all supposed to be custom fitted and all that, but we're seeing that it's off the shelf, unneeded, sent out by the dozen. And so it's the same fraud, same circus, just different clowns.
Yep.
And then home visits is another area of we've seen a big impact, a big increase in the number of home visits, including, again, going back to this therapy, we have billings for the same therapist doing telehealth and home visits on the same day with the same patient.
Well, I mean, listen, with all deference, the person was so messed in the head that they had to turn off the phone calls.
I got to get over there right now.
I got to get over stat. But, you know, I think, look, on the home visit piece, the piece of that makes it interesting, and I did a lot of those cases at OIG. My one of my favorite ones was a podiatrist, oddly enough, who was going from building to building, community room to community room. Captive audiences, just absolute captive audiences, like, why not? And, you know, I think we're going to see a lot of those as you know, that with that uptick of people getting used to a sedentary lifestyle, right, from, you know, leftover from COVID or what have you. So it's a lot on the plate. I want to come back to you in a minute because I do want to close out with another thing, but I want to go back to Wade for 1 minute because, you know, one of the things that happens in a new year oftentimes are new coverage regulations. And, you know, for a lot of people that follow us, you know, you may not understand kind of the regulatory piece of this, but when CMS goes to cover something new, it's because they're given it, basically it's congressional approval through a regulation. CMS doesn't just get to say, we're covering this, we're not covering this. There's an approval process, you're up for comment, because it's a policy. And when you make it a policy of coverage, it is subject to what they call the 60-day comment period. Well, one of the things that is being looked at as a potential coverage in 2025 is covering the GLP-1 drugs, the injectables for weight loss. You know, and it is interesting, if you know anybody that's taken these drugs, they are miraculous. I mean, I've seen people that I hadn't seen for months. I wouldn't call them obese, but they were a little on the fuller side. And then, you know, a couple of months later, see a picture of them on social media, you see them and it's like, whoa, what happened? Because they do work and they do have a great number of health benefits. But as everybody knows, these are $1,000+ a month. And there is talk about that being covered by Medicare. And so, Wade, this kind of goes into that general thing where as an investigator or an agent, you really need to be up to date on the latest and greatest of what's going to be covered, because this gets back to having that kind of side piece of investigative analytical part of knowing what's coming down the pipe. Because if these are covered, this now becomes a whole new world for the Part D benefit as a home injectable. It's a Part D covered drug. So now you've got the mail order piece, our patients opting in, right? So this just kind of lends itself to the conversations we have oftentimes about to be a really sharp investigator. You've got to kind of keep up with what's going on. And this is a kind of a classic example, right? You got to stay in tune with what the greatest and latest is.
Yeah, and I think the new year is probably a good time to, take it upon yourself to use sites like the HHS website, CMS website. They're going to have a, like a what's new section, or they're going to have updates available. And like you say, if you don't keep up on it, you're going to be referring to an old, statute or an old regulation that no longer is accurate. So, beginning of the year, not that it's a slow time for investigations, but you really have to make it a point to take time to kind of brush up on, okay, what's new? What do we need to be aware of? A lot of, if you go to the CMS page, there might be a lot of stuff that you can make a mental note that things have changed, but it's not something you're currently working. So it's not like you have to review the hundreds of pages of updates, but it's good to go through and familiarize yourself with the types of cases you're working, or again, just make a mental note of some changes so that if you do get assigned something or you open up something that you haven't done in the past, you know that, oh, there's something new this year. I have to go back and check it. But it's really upon the investigators to keep up on that, continuing education part of it. And in the SIUs, I mean, that's part of it too, is the continual training. I know at OIG we were very good at always training and updating stuff, but that's an important part that SIUs have to do, is look at that beginning of the year changes and kind of ongoing training throughout the year. It's important to keep that up.
Right. And that's the way you're going to be able to stay ahead of some of those curves, because you're going to kind of learn a little bit about what the policy is, what's going to be covered, what's not going to be covered. So, man, I want to go through this last piece. And this is, we want to stay away from discussions that are politicized. We want to stay away from discussions that are going to be hot button topics. But, we're coming to the end of the year. And, the number one thing, the person that committed the terrible, unthinkable murder of the CEO of United just agreed for extradition, just got into Manhattan the other day, has a multi-count indictment in front of him. Interestingly enough, there's also recently been a woman that was charged, I believe in Florida, with making threats towards the CEO of one of the Blues. And so there's this uptick. But what is interesting is the other day, United came out with a press release essentially trying to refute a lot of the arguments regarding some of the issues that people in the world of healthcare are arguing regarding denials. United came out and said, they wanted to demystify a lot of the arguments, saying that really 90% of claims are actually approved at first pass, and then another percentage on top of them are approved on appeal, and that most of the time that those denials are the result of some technical error or something along those lines. But what this does go to discuss really, and I want to get your final thoughts on this, is this whole premise of, is there going to be a shift away from payment integrity, and is there going to be a shift back to a patient-centric payment integrity type plan, where we're going to see less of this acrimonious relationship between the payer and the provider community? And will payment integrity become, for lack of a better way to put this, will they be back to being the redheaded stepchild of the payer environment?
This, the action by that, that assassin has had a bigger impact than probably he even imagined in his delusions. Because if you look at social media, if you look at the reactions of the plans themselves, I mean, some of them are already pulling back some of the regulations and policies and making them more provider friendly. So I think that pendulum is going to swing because it has shed a light on to the industry that what you're doing is not seen as being in the best interest of your own members. And I think, you know, at their heart, they want to keep their membership up and they want to keep the providers happy because that's how they make their money. So they're going to have to shift just to be in line with what they're being now shown is the true, you know, the true feeling of the people that they're serving. And then you throw into the mix as well, a new administration. You never know how that's going to swing that way, yeah. But you know, so I think if they're in line with, I know they've rightfully said that it's a horrible act that this person did, but they are also seeing the reaction to it. So it might be that this needs to be tweaked to where the patient and the provider are now more central to the system rather than the insurance company saying yay or nay. And then, you know, as you said, what does that do to program integrity? It might make us the bastard stepchild or the redheaded stepchild, or might just hone us down to, you know, where is the real fraud here? You know, have we overextended and made things fraud, waste, and abuse that are actually just medical decisions?
You know, and no offense to redheaded stepchildren, right? But
right.
I mean, look, and we're kind of seeing some of these things. Recently, there was a payer that had put out a policy that they were going to limit reimbursement for anesthesia for surgery.
Yeah.
Like basically, they were going to put time limits on surgery for anesthesia. You know, so does that mean like while you're under the knife, under anesthesia, is there like a stopwatch on your forehead? Hey, you got 5 minutes left. Cut faster. You know, so we're seeing some of these things that are being backed out and backed away, and some of these changes. You know, if you remember, there was a payer this past year. If you submitted a claim with modifier 25, it was an automatic prepay. Even if you weren't on prepay, you had to submit the documentation via fax to an 800 number or something. I mean, think about how many claims are going to come on, like actual paper claims that you would have had to have faxed to a machine to get paid. So I think we're seeing some of these changes are going to come. I mean, all of this is creating kind of these tectonic changes in the environment that we live in. Remember, the US healthcare system is inordinately unique. You know, we're really the only modern country that has the kind of payment structure that we have in this country, good, bad, or indifferent. It's what we have. But you know, the tragedy has put to light some things that maybe it'll trigger the payers to rethink how they're viewed nationally.
Yeah.
Not, you know, and it's terrible that it had to go to that, but it's, you know, maybe the time has come for some reshaping and rethinking of things. It is certainly going to have some effects on the way that payment integrity and SIUs are operating. And, you know, maybe that's going to create some streamlined focuses. Maybe it's going to put a better light on the way payment integrity and SIU functions work. And maybe it's really more about let's have really good policies for payment. Maybe, you know, things in the space of prior authorizations and step down therapies and things of that sort. Maybe there's going to be a change in that. You know, I've always been perplexed how when someone needs an MRI, how the MRI gets denied and they have to go to physical therapy first. And physical therapy, you know, some percentage of the time isn't working. So you've paid for physical therapy and then you've paid for an MRI. And then if the person needs an epidural, you know, like all of these other steps, and you have to at some point wonder, like, is it really a cost savings? Because you're paying someone on the payer side to deal with the prior authorization and the medical records, and then on the provider abrasion of having to have someone who does nothing but prior authorizations. And, you know, it seems like we're going to have, I really do think that in 2025, there are going to be some strong changes in the way that the payers process claims, think about that payment structure and things of that sort. And hopefully that will come with some transparency. But at the same time, I think it's also going to result in payment integrity and the SIUs having to kind of rethink what is fraud, what is waste, what is abuse, and what is just an educational session. It's a lot. 2025 is, I think, going to be a seminal year, considering we've got a new administration. We're going to have a new secretary of HHS. We're going to have a new CMS administrator. There is likely going to be some new people within the Center for Program Integrity on the Medicare side, the policymakers within CMS, which a lot of the commercial payers follow. Medicare Advantage follows the CMS guidance on a lot of that. We already know the administration is going to be taking a very hard look, the new administration, on what they continue to call the middlemen. For those of you that don't know that vernacular, that's the PBMs. We already know the president-elect has already made a lot of comments about the middleman. And positively, what he has actually been talking about is the fact that drugs cost too much. Why is it in this country you're paying X number of dollars for a drug that costs X minus in other places? So I think there's going to be a lot of shifts, and whether or not those shifts come with an excessive amount of fraud for those who are looking to continue to parlay their proceeds through nefarious activities remains to be seen. But I think we're going to have a very interesting 2025. For those of you that are familiar with Disney and used to do a lot of Disney, the ride is now closed, but I always say Mr. Toad's Wild Ride. You know how that ride had a different ending? If you did it, it had four or five different endings. I say, hang on. It's like Mr. Toad's Wild Ride. It's going to change on a dime. You never know. So I guess we'll see.
I was always run over by the train.
I could see that. I mean, you know. Yeah. Mostly because Charlie Chaplin didn't get there in time to get you off of the tracks. So I can understand that. Listen. I hope you guys have a good holiday, a good new year. We're going to see everybody after the new year for our first episode in 2025, first week of January. As always, again, we really do appreciate everybody taking the time to join us weekly on the OIG Roundtable, our year's worth of LinkedIn Lives. We have a great LinkedIn Live. We've already put it out. January, I think it's the 18th. I am doing a LinkedIn Live with the National Treasurer, Jean Stone, who I love like a family member. She is loved by all of us. If you know Jean Stone, you know she has been in this industry for going on 50 plus years. She is a 46-year veteran of CMS, back to the days when it was HEW, Health, Education, and Welfare, and HICVA. She is a wealth of information and knowledge. I'm going to have a great conversation with her about the Senior Medicare Patrol, the little-known but really important piece of the continuum for healthcare. Wade, I know you've talked about it. We've talked about it. So we've got Gene Stone in January. Again, the newsletter every week. Get it right to your inbox. Advise, advizehealth.com. You can get our weekly newsletter. You get the weekly podcast, LinkedIn Live, Spotify, YouTube, all of that. We really do appreciate everybody. We hope you have a great holiday. Stay vigilant. Social engineering is out there. Open enrollment is coming to an end. January is when we're going to see a huge uptick in fraud for all those people that got switched over to a Medicare Advantage plan that didn't know it because of nefarious sales reps working for the producers. So stay vigilant. We will see you all next year. And again, thank you for supporting us through the years. We appreciate you. Have a great time. We'll see you 2025.
Happy holidays, everyone.
Thank you.